Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Nonfiction, where in reality we discuss relevant topics of the past and the present. I'm your host, the communicator. Today's topic is the story of legendary film and stage star Paul Muni, and my guest is Elsie. Welcome, Elsie, to Nonfiction.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, this is not the first time you've been a guest on my shows, and they're always very highly rated and always talked about, and they're always chock full of information. So thank you so much for appearing on the show again. So, Elsie, it's said that Muni is the father of modern film acting. Do you agree with this statement, and why?
Well, I think he has a very good claim to that credit. Before Muni came into film acting at the very beginning of King Era, and he was specifically brought in, you know, by Warner Brothers to lend prestige from the stage to an art form that it may surprise a lot of people to know didn't have a lot of respect in those days. And they were looking for an actor who could bring that kind of prestige, modern acting, and realism to socially relevant dramas, which was what Warner Brothers decided to specialize in the early talkie era.
One of my favorite Muni films, I Am a Fugitive from a Chain Gang, is just as powerful today as when it was first aired in 1932. Elsie, why do you think the film's frenetic rawness still resonates?
I think that movie, more than almost any other of the social dramas that Warner Brothers did or movies from Muni's career, took dead aim at a social and emotional honesty that is extremely rare in any movie from any era. That movie does not pull its punches. There's no happy ending. And they really hold society's feet to the fire about what happened to war veterans and other victims of injustice in that era.
Yes. What a classic that is. So Muni cut his teeth in the Yiddish theater. How did the Yiddish theater begin, and why was it so important to the Jewish community?
The Yiddish theater is such an interesting and, you know, now, of course, lost part of American theater history. So what happened was, you know, around 1900, there was a huge influx of millions of Jewish people from Eastern Europe into the United States. And they were people who spoke Yiddish, which is the, you know, language of the Jewish people in that era. And the Yiddish theater developed into this high art form where they were doing plays about the immigrant experience. They were translating Shakespeare. And, you know, people who worked in places like the garment factories and, you know, all week would come to the Yiddish theater on Friday and Saturday nights to, it's almost like what you hear about with Shakespeare and the Globe Theater. They would bring food, they'd harass the players, they'd be emotionally transported. And it became something to go to even for people who didn't speak Yiddish, because it became renowned for this very natural, powerful style of acting, as opposed to, say, the more like a Sarah Bernhardt, you know, older style of acting that was still prevalent on the English-speaking stage at that time.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that the Yiddish theater goes back to the old country, goes back to Europe. I'm not thinking it started in America, right, Elsie?
No, it definitely did not. Muni was born into a Yiddish theater family. He was born,
right.
Muni Weisenfreund was his name, and his parents were actors in the Yiddish theater, by which in that era in Eastern Europe, they were street performers, and they would set up their show, go from town to town and set up their show in these, you know, Jewish communities.
Yes.
And perform. Muni's earliest memory was of shaking the tambourine in his parents' act. And they brought these traditions, the only one of which is still really well known today, are the stories that Fiddler on the Roof was based on.
Right.
But it was very much more than just those stories. There were hundreds of Yiddish plays.
Yes, yes, I can imagine. So when did Muni leave the Yiddish theater to go to greener pastures, so to speak, and why did he leave the Yiddish theater?
Well, what happened was Muni went from, you know, Yiddish vaudeville, essentially, you know, low-end Yiddish theater, to, as he got to be in his 20s and about 30, what they called the legitimate Yiddish theater or the Yiddish art theater, where he was becoming known as a fine actor. Well, about that time, the United States, it was 1924, cut off immigration from Eastern Europe. And so the audience for the Yiddish theater, as people assimilated, you know, they moved out of the Lower East Side of New York. They became English-speaking. They no longer were interested in Yiddish and speaking Yiddish. So almost immediately, the Yiddish theater began to die when those immigration restrictions were put in. Muni made the transition to the Broadway stage about 1928 and had his first English-speaking role then. And one of the things I think is the most amazing about him is there's no accent. There's no European accent there. He could
right.
do just about any accent. And he became just as well known as Muni Weisenfreund on the Broadway stage as he had been on the Yiddish stage in the late 20s.
We know that Muni was married for many years. Who was his wife, and can you give us some background info on her and how they met?
Yeah, sure can. They had one of the, you know, successful Hollywood marriages, I think precisely because it wasn't a Hollywood marriage.
Right.
Muni's wife, her name was Bella Finkel. And she was a member of the Tomaszewski family, which was one of the royal families of American Yiddish theater. Her uncle was Boris Tomaszewski. And Bella was an actress in the Yiddish theater herself.
Okay.
And her sister saw Paul Muni, or then Muni Weisenfreund, in a play, came home, said, "I bet the guy you got to marry." Bella said, "You think he's so great, you marry him." But they courted, they met, and went on dates through a matchmaker. The matchmaker would, you know, actually go on the date with you. You know, that was how it worked, you know, chaperone you.
Right.
And research your family background and, you know, determine whether or not they had a male matchmaker, thought you were compatible, and then you'd go on these dates and decide. And they got married in their early 20s, and he became an American citizen after they got married. You know, a lot, like a lot of immigrants, he he had the fantasy for a while that he would go back to Europe. And after he got married to Bella, who was an American, you know, he became an American citizen.
Right.
And, yeah, she was crucial to his success. When they went to Hollywood, Bella was, though not a great actress herself, you know, she was a good enough actress, but not a leading lady. She was very knowledgeable about acting. She was very knowledgeable about show business. She was his manager in the early days and did his contracts with Warner Brothers until, you know, they became successful enough to just to trust an agent to do that work for them. And she would go to the sets of his movies and essentially act as his acting coach, which a lot of directors didn't like. But his best performances came when she was there, and she provided that knowledge and that emotional support.
Yeah, it sounds like Bella was his rock. You know, and I think I heard you say that Bella was born in the U.S. and not Europe.
Yes, Bella was born in the United States. And I think one of the things that brought them together, too, was, you know, I don't want to get sidetracked, but they both had came from broken families. Muni's
right.
family broke up after they came to the United States. And he was on his own from about the time he was 15. His mother left his father, and then it's for a younger man, then his father died. And Bella's background was even worse. Her parents were both very well-known actors in the Yiddish theater, and her father shot her mother and then committed suicide in front of the children. So Bella Mervyn LeRoy was very good friends. The director was very good friends with both of the Munis. And he had this quote about Bella, like he said, "I loved Bella, but she was always so sad." And in pictures of Bella Muni, even when she's smiling, you see that in her eyes. Just this thing that you would never get over.
Yes.
And
yes. Wow.
Yeah. So he was her rock as well.
Yes. 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 They were each other's rock.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. And they had that in common too with the families. So Elsie, then Muni goes to Warner Brothers, but in his Hollywood career, which I found sort of astonishing, he only made 22 films with fellow Warner Brothers contract players like Betty Davis and James Cagney making scores of movies. Why do you think Muni only made 22 in his life, in his career?
Well, I think there were, you know, several reasons, and I think it's one of the reasons he was made such an impact at the time but is less well known today.
Yes.
Because people, you know, like to consume all these, you know, enjoy watching old movies. Number one, he was one of the only actors in Hollywood in that era who was allowed to choose his own work. He wasn't really a contract player. He had a clause in his contract that he could develop his own projects. And so he took his time about it, and Warner Brothers at that time was, you know, essentially he was what, you know, we call now Oscar bait. He was like Daniel Day-Lewis, say, today.
Yes.
You know, he doesn't make many movies, but when he does, you know, there's an Oscar nomination coming your way, and the studio really wanted that. And he would develop these prestige pictures like The Story of Louis Pasteur, you know, Emile Zola, Juarez, a lot of these historical dramas that worked in themes that were contemporary to the 30s. That's how they got away with it. You know, they were social commentaries disguised as historical dramas. And he was allowed to take his time about, you know, one picture a year versus, you know, three or four pictures a year like those other players.
Yes, and it's amazing, Elsie, in the early 30s, I was looking up Joan Blondell's career, and in the early 30s, Blondell was making up to 15, 16 pictures a year.
Incredible.
And for Warner Brothers.
Yeah, for
Warner Brothers. And then you look back at those performances, and she never mailed it in. She always gave a great performance, but I guess with Muni, it was actually the quality as opposed to the quantity.
It was the quality, and it's what they, like I say, they were fulfilling each other's needs. He had it, in, you know, he could go back and do a play in New York if he wanted to. He could go to Mexico with the director, William Dieterle, and, you know, spend 6 months researching Juarez. It was a prestige thing that worked for him, and it worked for Warner Brothers because, well, Jack Warner had this, you know, many quotations, right? But one of them was, you know, we lose money every time he sticks on a beard. But really, they weren't necessarily looking to Muni's movies to make a ton of money. They were looking for them to win awards and to make
right.
the studio gain this prestige of our art movies.
So speaking of putting on beards, Muni seemed to specialize in, as you say, the historical, biographical type of films and characters. Even so much so, he generally, as you say, looked exactly like the person he was playing. An amazing talent, wouldn't you say, Elsie?
Yes, and it was very interesting for me to learn that that was very much part of what made you considered a great actor in the Yiddish theater. I mean, that's directly
right.
out of the Yiddish theater, that if you could, when he was a young man, you know, a teenager, he was got the nickname in Yiddish theater, Old Man Makeup, because he could develop the hair, the makeup, the beards. Some players in Yiddish theater, even you can find pictures, made these elaborate masks. It was very dynamic and creative. And that was something that, I mean, I honestly think Paul Muni felt like he was cheating people if he didn't look completely different from the last movie. He never wanted to repeat himself. He had no interest in being recognized as a star. He didn't play the game at all. And
right.
I think he felt like he was cheating people if he didn't have, you know, a beard or an accent or, you know, some way that he was playing a person completely different from Paul Muni.
You know,
and I think
you know,
that's
Elsie,
the way, yeah, wait, yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. I was just saying,
well,
I think
know,
that's the way in which the Daniel Day-Lewis analogy in our own time really works, is we never see, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis playing the dad in a sitcom, right?
Right.
Right.
You know, Elsie, on that note, one of the films he made was sort of controversial, The Good Earth,
right,
where Muni
right.
and the other lead characters portray Chinese peasants. Elsie, do you think Muni ever second-guessed himself later on for playing that role?
Well, there is a quote from Muni where he did say, "I'm as Chinese as Herbert Hoover." So, yeah, he did acknowledge that you know, the casting was, you know, like just what they did back then, right? But,
yes.
You know, even at the time, the author of The Good Earth, Pearl Buck, was frustrated
yes.
that Hollywood, you know, refused to consider. I mean, they never considered making the movie with an all-Chinese cast. Mooney was generally was the main person considered for the male lead in that movie, though I have read that they did a screen test with James Stewart, which I just, like, does that still exist? I mean, you know, if you think Paul Mooney's not Chinese, I got to see James Stewart try out
no,
for that
No, I could
part.
Not see James Stewart in that role.
No,
no way. You know, but on the but on the second note, on the second note on that same line, I mean, I'm a big anime Wong fan, and
mm-hmm.
now the story goes, legend has it that anime Wong did a screen test for Olan in The Good Earth, and the story goes that after she did the test, she had the crew in tears. It was so good. But yet they still gave it to Louise Rainier. Now, I know Louise won her second back-to-back Oscar for The Good Earth, for Olan. But, you know, there's always a part of me that says, man, I really wish I would have seen or I could have seen, you know, anime play that role.
Yeah, there's just a real what might have been sense about
yes.
The Good Earth now. I mean, it's a if you can set aside, like, to people listening, just set aside the controversy. The Good Earth is truly one of the great epics of early Hollywood, and it really is a wonderful watch. And Paul Mooney and Louise Rainer do not seem Chinese, but they're very good as this family struggling against hardship, tragedy, and nature, which are, you know, qualities that really resonated with audiences in the 1930s. And that's why The Good Earth was so popular. That's why Gone with the Wind was so popular. Wasn't
yes.
necessarily the historic drama or the ethnic drama. It was that it was mirroring the people were experiencing in their lives. So if you can set aside the racial controversy, it's still a really good watch.
Mooney in his personal life seemed to be totally altruistic and sympathetic to humanitarian causes such as sharecropper rights. Was this instilled in him by his upbringing or developed later, you think?
Well, I think kind of both.
Okay.
Mooney's family was just struggled. They were poor. They were theater people who never succeeded. And he went into the theater just as a teenager. But there was a very strong sense in the Jewish community at that time of social justice activism. You think about things that were going on, like the immigration, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, you know, the racial injustices, Sacco and Vanzetti. There were just all
right.
these social causes that shaped people, and there's this feeling in the Jewish community that you, in that era, that you were obliged to be outspoken about these things. And though he was a, you know, not a brash person personally, he felt this obligation in his movies, that his movies and his plays should. He didn't make very many comedies, you know, not that he didn't enjoy playing comedic roles, but he felt like it should be important, right? And it was something that he developed, I think it's something that Bella really believed in as well, is that if you had any success, you should use your voice to make your views about justice known. And in the 1930s, those were the causes that were resonating throughout the country, the racial stuff, the rise of Hitler in Europe, and the economic injustice that people faced.
Yes, and Elsa, you mentioned the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory Fire. I think we just, you know, had an anniversary of that yesterday. I think that was something. But you know, Elsie, it's noted that Muni's major passions, one of his major passions was assisting European Jews. In what way was he able to perform this assistance?
Well, of course, Muni was born in modern-day Ukraine. He was an Eastern European Jew. And he kept very up to date on what was happening in Eastern Europe, which was, you know, the Russians and then the rise of Nazi Germany, leading to Jews being forced into ghettos, pogroms, and then the beginnings and execution of the mass killing of European Jews.
Yes.
And, the first area in which he was involved was the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League, which a lot of very respected actors we know today were involved with, like Edward G. Robinson, Frederick March, and, several dozen of Hollywood's leading liberals, we would call them today, were involved in the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League to try to get more movies made that alerted people to what was happening in Europe and shape American public opinion, which they faced a lot of pushback about from studios, of course, who avoid controversy, and also the production code, which would censor out mentions of what was happening in Europe in order to be able to release the movies in Nazi-dominated countries. Later, though, during the war, once the war had started, Muni became involved with writer Ben Hecht, who was a great Hollywood screenwriter, had written the script for Scarface, among many other great movies.
The Front Page, I think he did as well, right?
He did The Front Page.
Right.
Yeah, if you look up Ben Hecht on the Internet Movie Database, you'll be amazed by all the scripts he was involved with. Well, he wrote the first two very important plays. One was during the war, called We Will Never Die, and it was a play about what was going on in Eastern Europe. And it was the first play, it was on the radio, and it also toured the country, to really let people know the scale of what was happening with the Holocaust. It wasn't even called the Holocaust yet. That word wasn't coined. And right after the war, Muni did a play with Ben Hecht called A Flag Is Born, that was probably one of the most Zionist plays to ever be on Broadway. It's just a frank appeal for the creation of the State of Israel and to, save the millions of Jews who had survived the Holocaust and were rotting in displaced person camps in Europe, and put pressure on the British government, which then controlled, Israel, to let these Jews immigrate. And the play, they used the money to buy an old Coast Guard cutter and try to smuggle in a bunch of Jews into modern day Israel. And that in itself would make a great movie. He was very outspoken about it.
Yeah, that sure would make a great movie.
Yeah,
you know,
it would.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We all know and see Muni's famous roles like Scarface and Chain Gang and Emile Zola. Elsie, are there any lesser-known roles in films of his that you feel he stood out in?
Yes, I do. There's a one movie that he made during World War II that I actually think is a very fine movie, even though it has kind of a cheesy title, I guess. But it's called Commando Strike at Dawn. And it's about the occupation of Norway, one of the small countries that was rolled over by Nazi Germany, and the resistance of the Norwegian people. And Muni looks totally normal in this movie, okay? He doesn't wear any beard up. and he's a Norwegian, ordinary man in a Norwegian village, and how he goes from being an ordinary man to what is the responsibility of us as an ordinary person to resist when something like this happens. So that's one of my favorite Muni, lesser known one. Another one is Stranger on the Prowl, which he made in Italy after the war. It's filmed in a bombed out Italian city, and it's about a man with no name. You never find out anything about him. It's sort of like a sequel to Fugitive almost, a man with no name in this bombed out Italian seaport who seems to be on the run, and then he's befriended by this young Italian boy who is so innocent, right? He tries to help this man. And that's one I really recommend people look for, is Stranger on the Prowl. It is available on DVD, and I'm not sure if it's streaming, but he gives a very interesting performance in that movie, and it's a chance to see Muni when he's a little bit older, which is not that easy to do because he mostly did theater work in his later years.
Stranger on the Prowl. I'm going to look that up. That's very interesting. I've never even heard of that film. But you know, Elsie, Muni's last film was one of his best, The Last Angry Man, which he again was nominated for Best Actor. And Muni, in my estimation, goes out with a bang.
Mm-hmm. The Last Angry Man is a very good movie. It was the only time in the movies that Muni got to play a Jewish character. You know, he played French, Mexican, Chinese, Norwegians. He gets to play Jewish, an old Jewish doctor in a neighborhood that's changing from Jewish immigrants to black people coming up from the South. And that's, you know, that's what it's about. He's spent his whole life in this community. And it also has to do with a reality TV show, believe it or not, is the catalyst that drives the plot in this movie, where someone gets the idea of putting this old guy on a reality TV show. So it's also a commentary on reality versus what TV likes to present to us. It's a very interesting movie, and a plum role that Edward G. Robinson also fought hard to get that part and was very mad that Paul Muni got the part instead of he did, because it's a plum role for an older actor.
And ironically, Muni and Edward G. Robinson knew each other growing up in New York, I believe. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, they're just about exactly the same age, and they even went to the same elementary school in New York.
Oh, wow, look at that.
Yeah.
And then later on,
they were rivals. They weren't friends.
Yes,
you know?
yes. So, Elsie, in closing, In your vast research of this great human being, were there any things that you feel that are not ever mentioned about Muni that we should know about?
I think that we have lost in modern times an appreciation for the dedication of craft. We have so much that's artificial now, more all
yes.
the time. And when we see someone who has a foot in the 19th century and the, you know, classical acting tradition where you traveled around with a trunk full of costumes ready to play any part from the old man to the female lead if she couldn't go on. And then the other foot in, you know, Muni has sometimes been called the first method actor, you know, the other foot mm-hmm. in the revolution in acting that came after. I'd like for people to, you know, take the time to appreciate watching or seeing something that isn't just candy. You know, it's not just entertainment. It's a chance to see part of American theater history in the person of this one man. And I would just really encourage people to dive in once in a while. It's not like eating spinach. I think you'll find it very satisfying to appreciate something that has meaning beyond just watching a flick one night.
Yes, and you always hear about the Humphrey Bogarts and Errol Flynns and Jimmy Cagneys, but when you sit and actually watch a Paul Muni film, you'll be transfixed on how great an actor he is.
Yeah, you will. I mean, this is something special that you can seek out to see. And it's, like you say, it's not the kind of movie where you sit there reading a magazine while it's on. Take
yes.
the time to appreciate what you're seeing, and you'll be glad you did.
You've been listening to a new and exciting concept in podcasting called Nonfiction. My guest has been the wonderful Elsie, who can be followed on Twitter by what else? At Mr. Paul Muni. Of course. Thank you so much, Elsie, for coming on the show, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
It was a pleasure. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.